When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Did you know it's been 14 years this month since the last time we raised the minimum wage? And what's interesting to me is over the weekend, I had a conversation with somebody. It's kind of that which side are you on, you know, red hat, blue hat thing that I often get myself in the middle of. And I say, look, I'm on the side of working people. And right now, the only people who seem to be looking out for working people in this moment are the people wearing the blue hats. I wish there was a time. Where the red hats, you know, gave a rat's behind about working people, but it's just not there. So as I was looking up, you know, the history of the minimum wage increase, because it has been so long, 14 years, that's a couple of presidencies ago. That's an entire Obama 8 years. That's the 4 years of Donald Trump. And thus far, well, 2 years of the Biden administration. And you're looking at, you know, all the way back to Bush. And I was thinking about it. My daughter wasn't even born yet when this was going on. And it's one of those things where you go, for some, that's a lifetime ago, the last time we raised the minimum wage. And I went back and I looked at, you know, how it happened, you know, because I was remembering it. And I remember that we had George Miller, the Democrat from California, on the show when they proposed this. Back in 2007, you had, you know, this is a long time ago, 2007, they introduced it right at the beginning. It was part of the first 100-hour plan for the new Democratic majority in the House, and they banged it right through. All 233 Democrats voted to increase the minimum wage, as you would have expected. But interestingly enough, in the House, you had 82 Republicans who came along to increasing the minimum wage, just to increase the minimum wage. Now, you had 116 Republicans who, no, we will not do such a thing. And at the time, you know, you go, wow, that's a lot. I mean, can you imagine today? Now, Bush, you know, who was president then, said, no, we can't pass a minimum wage increase without gaining a pound of flesh for the business community, and said we need tax cuts because that's the right-wing conservative Republican fix for everything. It's the one thing they're always in favor of, tax cuts. And they claimed it was for small businesses because they wanted to offset the increase in the minimum wage. So we, the taxpayers, are going to pay the cost of, and this is the thinking on this is remarkable. The taxpayers are going to pay the cost of increasing the wage for low-wage workers. Which is just mind-blowingly amazing. Now, the Senate, they would have no part of a clean minimum wage increase. The Republicans would not allow a cloture vote. 43 Republican senators voted against allowing a cloture vote. So had to go back and add that tax break for the corporate folks in there. And miraculously, it passed the Senate 94-3. You just had three Republicans who voted against it and one who didn't vote, and two Democrats who didn't vote. And that happened on February 1st of 07. So, you know, again, this is great. You know, we're moving along on the minimum wage. The House passed it. The Senate passed it again, middle of May of 07. Had to do it as part of the Iraq War Supplemental Aid Bill. But $257 million went to businesses over a 10-year period, you know, to offset the increase, you know, to kind of make it a little easier to swallow the fact that they were going to have to pay their workers something. Now, tipped workers got bupkis. Nothing. Federal minimum wage, even to this day, $2.13 an hour. Let that roll off your tongue a few times. $2.13 an hour, and you go, but, you know, they get tips, of course. And for me, it became, you know, as I was thinking about this, this is kind of the, you know, the which side are you on kind of a scenario. If everything that Republicans have to do is good, well, we got to pay the master. You got to pay the business owners to do right by their employees. It's incredible to me. And I'm looking at what's going on with UPS. And the Teamsters are doing informational pickets all across the country. They're practicing. They're showing people, hey, look at us, and doing an incredible job. But this is a company that is wildly profitable. I mean, wildly profitable. They 2022 had over $100 billion in total revenue. Let that roll off your tongue a few times. $100 billion in total revenue. 13.9 of that pure profit in their pockets out the door. And then you add on top of that the fact that $8.6 billion in stock buybacks and, you know, almost $46 million in compensation for the executives. You know, they need a little extra cheese on their Whopper. And for me, the key number in this is that $8.6 billion in stock buybacks. Because again, remember, these are the people who told us, you know, give us tax breaks, help us offset our costs, and we'll invest it in new equipment and better wages for workers. We're going to do the good stuff. We're benevolent. We're the benevolent employers. And that $8.6 billion says to me that they have nothing more productive to do with that money than to enrich the shareholders and the executives. Because that $8.6 billion should have been plowed back into the business, into compensating workers who made the $100 billion in revenue. Just seems simple to me. But again, it's another one of these, which side are you on? Are you on the argument side of, you know, well, those UPS workers, they make a lot of money? Yeah, because they produce an incredible profit. They should share in that. So either you believe that it's a meritocracy that we live in, because this is what conservatives tell me they believe in. Either you believe in that idea and that, hey, these workers are producing an enormous amount of profit. These workers are producing an enormous amount of growth. So much so that you just said, hey, $8.6 billion of that, yeah, we can just, you know, send it away. Either you believe that or you believe that, you know what, we're all just cogs in a machine. And workers are disposable, and you'll take what you get, and you won't throw a fit, as my wife used to tell the kids. And right now, you've got workers who are saying, no, we're... And it's just not at UPS. It's at a number of places across this country where workers are fed up. And we're in a moment. Again, which side are you on in this moment? Are you on the side of people saying, look, we should have dignity and respect in work? Or, you know what, we're just here at the will of the employer, at the whim of their benevolence. And this is where, you know, this is where you test your soul. Because red hat, blue hat has consequences. Red hat, blue hat gets you blue hat, decent wages. Red hat, well, you're on your own, buddy. Free market. How many times did Ron Paul say there should be no minimum wage? If you're desperate enough to work for a buck an hour, you know what? That's the free market. If that's all you're worth, that's what you get. So again, which side are you on? For instance, there's another moment where healthcare is front and center. Personally, I would do healthcare a whole lot differently than Red Hat and Blue Hat right now. But understand, the Affordable Care Act did some incredible stuff, set some standards, opened up opportunities for people to get insured for the first time in their lives, saved people's lives. And what did we get out of Republicans? What was the response? We're going to repeal and replace it. And you'd go, okay, what are you going to replace it with? Well, clearly, pay or die. Because that's all they have. There's no policy chops in this debate. It's pay or die. And right now, they're off the repeal and replace bit, and now they're going after, hey, let's just destroy the ACA by coming out with and strengthening these ridiculous short-term policies that the Trump administration really put up for front and center. Understand, with the ACA, we set a floor, said, you know what, health insurance has to at least cover this minimum. And, you know, preventative care, a set amount of visits, no caps, all kinds of things that they put in place that said, you know what, we're not going to allow you to cheat consumers because they didn't read the fine print. Well, what Republicans want is they want to, well, undo all of that, which is why we're in this moment. You know, again, which side are you on? The Biden administration is talking about ending these junk insurance policies. And we know what they are. They're those ones where, you know, hey, you can get this great health insurance card for, you know, $8 a month, and it'll be fabulous because it'll cover absolutely nothing. And Republicans have passed a piece of legislation that would make this even longer. It's called the Choice Arrangement Act. Custom Health Option and Individual Care Expense Act. The Choice Arrangement Act. And what it is it says, look, you know what? The policy that you get may not cover anything. It will undo all of the things that the ACA has done, like bring back pre-existing conditions. Sorry, we're not going to cover that pre-existing conditions. Sorry, we're only going to pay X amount over the lifetime of this policy. And if you exceed that, well, that's it. That's all we're paying. You know, you don't get maternity care. You don't get prescription drugs. You don't get a whole bunch of stuff. Now, what the right will tell you as well, the consumer, they know. You know, they know that it's a crappy plan. They know they're rolling the dice, buying something of minimal coverage. And the reality is most people don't know, which is why 80% of bankruptcies in this country are because of medical debt. Because people are still getting screwed over by a health insurance system that, well, profits the very wealthy. And, you know, as I said, during the Obama years, they set rules limiting what these insurers can get away with. Also, they set limits on these junk policies. And they said for 3 months, like if you're changing jobs, okay, you need some gap stuff that'll help you get to your next job. Okay, we understand that the system is set up to help you get to the next spot. Okay. Personally, I would open up the ACA and make it immediately that day you lose your job, bang, you get that. But I get it. You short term. What did the Trump administration do? Well, they allowed plans to be 365. And I think up to 3 years. So it's no longer about stopgap anymore. It's about, well, this is your policy. And what's interesting is, you know, these junk policies, according to the Congressional Budget Office, they're saying about 1.5 million people have them. And I have to wonder how many people actually know that what they got is junk and that they're rolling the dice. How many people actually get that, you know, maybe you're not covered for cancer. Maybe you didn't check the right box. Maybe you didn't check the right box and then said, well, sorry, heart attacks are, you know, those aren't covered. You'll have to get a coupon for that. And I ask the simple question, should this be how a system is run, where we spend more money on health care and on health insurance than any country in the world, and we get worse outcomes? Again, which side are we on in these moments? And for me, this is just another one of those examples where you have to, which hat, which camp are you in this moment? Because there doesn't seem to be any sanity in the center. Of, hey, how do we make sure that everyone gets to move forward? So for me, picking up the blue hat. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Let me know what you think. Have you ever had one of these junk policies? Because I did years and years ago, right when I was first starting out. I was working for a security guard company. And I was getting the health insurance for $60 a month. I still remember it. And I went to go to the doctor and like, oh, sorry, we don't cover any of that. What a rude awakening that was. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, this again, you know, in this world of red hat, blue hat, and as was pointed out to me, the Republicans only care about workers when they're in utero. Again, not a shocking point at all. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on line one. Alice, how are we doing?
I'm insane. We're in good shape.
All right. That's good. Good start.
Okay. So what I wanted to say is you were talking about the junk insurance in the hospital stays and rolling the dice, et cetera. And really, people need to set up and pay attention to what is going on because, you know, I'm still receiving bills from my husband's three hospital stays, you know, January into February, and then March, and then April, you know, on down. And the second hospital visit, which was only 3 days, it cost $483,000.
Wow.
For 3 days. So if they think that it's not going to happen to them, they need to wake up because it will happen. The hospital bills are outrageous, and they're going to end up having to file for bankruptcy.
No, I mean, like my daughter, when she broke her arm, it was like $18,000. I mean, it's a broken arm. It was crazy.
It is crazy. And, you know, hospital visit number two, and my husband was in there for like 3.5 days, and that was when you know, he was jaundiced from, they had given him all that medication and stuff, which kicks the pancreatitis in, and he was in there for 3 days, and he had to get a procedure done, and that was it. I mean, $483,000 and some odd dollars. I mean, that's insane. But, you know, the Republicans, they don't care, and the evangelicals don't care. And
well, we'll crowdsource
it's just a
crowdsource.
It's crazy.
No, I mean, it's insane where we are, Alice. I appreciate the call, though. Thanks. I got to move along. Let's go. Let's CJ in Madison, Wisconsin on line two. How you doing, CJ?
I'm good. Thanks for taking my call again, Rick.
What's on your mind, brother?
If you recall, thank you very much. If you recall, during Obamacare, the Republicans offered amendments to the policy, which it was deemed it's no longer Obamacare because it's considered a tax and not a forced mandate, but that the Republicans offered amendments to cheapen insurance by allowing it to be sold across state lines. And one thing we know, competition makes anything better. competition capitalism makes things better.
Yeah, I disagree with that. I disagree with that blanket statement.
The nail by the Democrat.
Yeah, I disagree with the blanket statement you made. CJ, relax. I do remember that fight. And I do remember that, you know, the Affordable Care Act turned into a lot of very conservative ideas. And thanks to Joe Lieberman for that. So we didn't get what I wanted, and not what a lot of people wanted on the left. This was a bill that nobody was overly happy with. But I'll tell you this, CJ, it has saved people's lives.
Or on the right.
Yeah, I mean, look, you're going to make the argument that the competition. So this idea of competition. So you're going to be willing to. I'm not going to cover myself for this, or I'm going to allow this to be in there to cheapen the cost. It's like, you know, it's like the conversation I had with my son about motorcycle insurance. This idea that, you know, you get what you pay for. If you buy crap insurance, CJ, you're going to get garbage. And we see that in these short-term plans. This we know. So there's got to be a way forward that both of us can agree that people don't go bankrupt because of health insurance.
I agree. And one of those things was to pick and choose what you need. I don't need a paternity care. I don't plan on having a baby. So for me to pay for people, you know, to have that in a group, you should be able to buy in groups. You should be able to focus. You should be able to buy across state lines. And competition is what makes it more affordable. And it's not. And we're actually living what your party passed right now. So the cost has not gone down. You haven't been able to choose your doctors all the time. And it's gone up. So I wouldn't exactly call Obamacare a success.
It's saved people's lives, CJ. I have spoken with people who are eternally grateful that they're walking this earth because someone got something passed. Is it perfect? No, not even close. And I'll be the first to say that it is not perfect, that we should have been doing what we did with Medicare from the beginning, and that is tweaking it to make it better. All we got from Republicans was repeal and replace. And what was their plan to replace it with? Basically, pay or die. It's basically what you're saying. You should be able to get the crappiest insurance we can get. If you're willing to take these risks and these risks, that's your right, CJ.
You want to know what they offered?
I know what they offered. They offered health savings accounts.
That was demonized? Oh, no, yes, and only 10%. If you would start as a young person who doesn't want to buy big-time insurance because they're healthy, they would be allowed to put 10% of their Social Security into an account
So we're now going to go after and gut Social Security.
What they're getting now.
You know, it's amazing to me, CJ, and I got to move along here in a second, but it's amazing that it's always going after Social Security. It's always, hey, let's see how we can the death of 1,000 paper
cuts.
It's
going broke, Rick.
It's amazing to me how that works, but I appreciate the call, CJ. Thanks. I appreciate it. No, and this is, again, one of these things that the right does masterfully. You know, we're going to put competition in there. We're going to have that blind faith belief that's going to fix all problems. And what competition will get you is the lowest plan, the lowest things, the fine print that most people don't read. And that's the problem with these junk plans, because people think, hey, I'm getting insurance. It's like, well, my kid with the motorcycle insurance. His friend goes, I've got full coverage. I pay $100 a year. And I said to him, no, we went and got insurance that actually covers him. If he hits something, his bike is covered. The person that he hits is covered. If there's any damage, it's covered. And these are the limits. And we walk through this, whereas the state minimum coverage is basically nothing. And this is the same thing with the health insurance. They want to make it the same thing. Where at the end of the day, though, who ends up getting stuck with the bill? We, the taxpayers. Because thanks to people not having insurance, we all cover that. Because as a society, and I don't care what CJ says, and maybe he's willing to let people die on the street, but decent Americans are never going to allow people to die on the street corners and not allow them to get the care that they need. And are we doing a great job of it? No, we should be doing better. And this is where I call to both sides. Red Hat and Blue Hat, do better. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, another one of these which side are you on moments. And look, the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and we've talked about them numerous times over the years. They're holding, I guess the next couple of days it's coming up, their annual meeting. This time it's going to be in Orlando. And oh boy, I just can't wait to find out what kind of anti-worker, anti-consumer, anti-citizen garbage is going to ooze out of this orgy of greed and fascistic fanaticism. But here we are. It's coming. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what we might expect from the ALEC folks, the good corporate folks. I've asked Don Wiener to come talk with us. He's a writer and researcher with the good folks over at the Center for Media and Democracy. Their website, exposedbycmd.org. Don, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi there.
I gotta tell you, every time ALEC gets together, nothing good comes of it. And you've got a piece out right now on what you think is coming out of this ALEC meeting. Walk me through, one, who is ALEC and what do they normally do? And then walk me into what you think's coming.
Sure. ALEC is a gathering of Republican state legislators. They come from all the states. They meet together, and meeting with them are corporate lobbyists and other corporate representatives. And together, behind closed doors, they put together their wish list of legislation they'd like to see at the state level. And then the state legislators go back to their states, having been prompted by the corporate lobbyists on how to talk about what they're introducing. They introduce the legislation, and then we have fights all over the country at the same time on the same pieces of legislation, because they usually copy it verbatim from what they decide.
Yeah, and in a number of places, Don, the legislators don't even take their names off of it.
Right.
They leave the American Legislative Exchange Council's name on. Don't even put their own name on their homework. It's always funny when someone forgets to do that, but they do.
To do a job. They've also got staff people in many cases, right, who should be doing this, but they don't. It gets spoon-fed to them. And they introduce every year a dozen or so new bills. A lot of those bills are anti-worker or anti-environment or anti-consumer. They all are kind of bills your listeners are probably familiar with, degrading the environment, attacking unions and working people. I just wrote an article that appeared today on our website about one very disturbing proposal that ALEC is recommending to its members that they vote and bring back to their states. And that's a proposal that would prevent employers from voluntarily recognizing labor unions under neutrality agreements. So here we have a Republican Party that believes in the free market and that employers should not be interfered with, putting forth a proposal that says you cannot recognize a union even if you want to.
Now, this is the same, just so I get this clear, Don, this is the same Republican Party who tells me that they want smaller, less intrusive government, get government out of my life. And it sounds like what you're telling me is they want to put government right between you and your relationship with your employer.
Right. Well, it's the power of the state, Rick. I mean, they want to use the government to put a wedge between employers and employees. And what the proposed bill says is that as an employer, you cannot receive any subsidies from a state. So those would be tax breaks or grants or money for workforce development. You cannot receive any subsidies from the state if you voluntarily agree to allow the union into the shop to try to organize the members. So you're not even preventing them from having a union. You're preventing them from trying to have a union.
So let me ask you this. Now they're dead set against unions, and I look at the state of Tennessee, where the Tennessee Employee Free Choice and Privacy Act, I guess this is what this is based on, according to your article. So the companies can't freely say, you know, we're going to be neutral, we're not going to harass and intimidate, we're not going to hold captive audience meetings, we're not going to threaten to fire workers, we're not going to fire people, we're not going to threaten to close, we're not going to do any of this stuff that we've been getting away with. We're just going to let people decide, and where the chips fall, we may. Then no money. What happens if the unions go in and organize anyway? Do they then still hold the company, you know, liable and then take the money, which would even make the employer even more anti-union? Is that part of this too?
I think that's right. I mean, or the facility wouldn't get built. they will use their tax subsidies as a cudgel to try to pressure the employer into not having, basically having reasonable relationship with their union. So the example, what happened in Tennessee, and I suspect, Rick, you've told your listeners about what went on in Tennessee last month and the month before. The Republicans there are not the smartest group of legislators, and they provided $900 million to Ford to build a new lithium battery plant in the state. And they didn't realize that if you invite Ford in, the UAW comes with it.
Right.
And they woke up and they realized that when it was pointed out to them that the UAW has an arrangement with Ford where Ford will not prevent them from talking to workers and trying to sign them up. You know, get union cards. You get a majority of cards. You have a recognized union.
Yeah, but here's the crazy part, Don. With you. Here's the screwy part of this. If I'm a legislator in Tennessee, I want those 5,600 jobs in my state. I want those jobs to be as good a paying job as I can possibly get. So one, I can say, hey, look what I brought. But two, and more importantly, they're making more money, which means that's going to reverberate through the local economy. It means more tax base. It means more other jobs. It means, you know, it means finally you're pushing a low road economy upward. I don't see the downside in here. What's the problem here? This just sounds like it's just hatred of unions and just bad economics.
Well, you know, we're not for all tax incentives. Remember, Charles Koch, who I follow pretty closely, his company, the oil conglomerate, Koch Industries, has received almost $500 million in tax incentives when the company doesn't need it. Ford is saying, we'll strike a bargain with you. We'll go to the banks. We'll use our own money, our shareholder money, and we'll build a new plant. But you've got to chip in something. So there's some incentives that make sense, Rick, like you say. And here, Ford would not build the plant were the state not chipping in some money. But now this subsidy for Ford is grand-personed in. So the bill took effect a few months ago, but the Ford plant incentive has already been provided. So this is them realizing after the fact that they made a mistake, and they don't want to do this ever again, which is encourage a union to come into the state.
No, it just sounds
it's a right to work state. They have a terrible record on labor rights, and they find themselves with a pretty aggressive union, UAW, coming into their state.
No, I get that. I get the idea. I get the ideology. I get that you're anti-worker. But if there's a company that wants to come in, that is willing to pay superior wages with good benefits and all of this, and you a high road employer, I got to tell you, I don't see the downside in bringing them in, other than it's just purely ideology. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Is there something I'm missing in this?
The problem you've been talking about probably for a few years now, which is you've got a Republican Party that's appealing to a slice of voters. They're base. And these people are ideologues, right? And you can try to explain to them the benefits of having those jobs, and how everybody else benefits, but they're so angry and so resentful that they're ideologically predisposed to opposing anything that has the word union in it.
Yeah. No, and here's the thing. This is what gets me, and I guess this is the other part of the ideology. You know, I go back to myself. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland as a young kid, and I remember the neighbor who got a UAW job at Ford, oddly enough, in Cleveland. And, you know, I remember seeing firsthand their lives got better. They had food at the end of the month. They got a secondhand car. The kids got bikes. They eventually moved out of the neighborhood. So as at a very young age, the frame of union job, better life was stuck in my head. Part of me goes, maybe this is what they're afraid of. That they're going to see that these jobs are going to make people's lives better, that these jobs are going to be, you know, the best paying jobs in the area, and then there's going to be competition and people going, hey, I want jobs like that. And so there's part of me that goes, I can see why they would be against it, because you don't want people to get a taste of what could be. So I'm thinking that frame. Do you agree?
Yes, I think that they don't want to give people a taste of a fair wage. Because then people move into the middle class, and they're stubbornly going to hold on to that. You know, Rick, I work for the Service Employees International Union, and the local I work for represents janitors. And we fight, you know, for $15 for our janitors. The auto workers may make $40 an hour. You know, our workers, you know, just like you in the housing project, they look at what the auto workers are making, and they realize, gee, that, you know, that's a place maybe I could wind up someday, but not if they crush the union.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. Let me ask you, Don. I mean, obviously, this is going to see a lot of activity. Which state should we be paying attention to the most? I would assume, you know, your basic red state, red legislature, red governor. You know, this has got to be something that'll make the Kochs and the moneyed interest pretty happy.
Well, here's the irony, Rick. A lot of the renewable energy projects that this country's building are being built in red states.
Yep.
And, you know, here you've got the hypocrisy of the Republican Party, which uniformly opposed Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, which provides incentives for solar, for lithium batteries, and for wind. They opposed it. But then when the projects come to their state, they brag about them and they run on them. So a lot of these projects are going to be in red states, and in most instances, the corporations are going to ask for some help. The minimum help they're going to ask for is workforce development help,
right?
Or they're going to ask for help in preparing the land or building roads to the site. They're going to ask for help, and I think you're going to see in Texas, Kentucky, Florida, these red states. There also happen to be right-to-work states, Rick. You're going to see fights where the companies just say, we're not coming.
Isn't that a good thing
so
for states that have the right to bargain?
Renewable energy future. It hurts everybody.
But wasn't that what we would want at a certain point? Go, we're going to build manufacturing in states that are going to be friendly to workers, not ones that are hostile?
Well, you know, Ford's neutrality agreement, which was hard fought by the UAW, you know, the strikes of the 30s and the 40s. It was not like Ford gave them entree into the workplace.
Right.
It was fought for, and people died for it, literally. And now Ford says, we're going to leave our members in the union alone. The members want to join the union, that's up to them, and we're going to stay completely neutral. And that's the kind of society I think we want to have, right?
Yeah. No, I'm right there. So last question I got for you, Don. I mean, in looking at this, you know, clearly we're going to see this in red states. This has got to be something that the labor movement takes on full-heartedly because, you know, once this starts, as you've said, a lot of those building projects that were going to be the next generation of middle-class, you know, solid working-class jobs, those are going to be cut off at the knees by these states. So what do people do?
Well, you've got to hold these legislators speak to the fire. You got to, well, one thing, the first thing you do is you have them explain the bill to you, which they can't even do because they're just taking something that's written by the corporation and copying it verbatim, right? So we find out frequently they can't even tell you what's in the bill or what it would do. So you challenge them on that. And then I think you have to force them to ask whether they want the jobs or not. They're stuck, you know, ideologically, as you say, they don't want unions in their state. But on the other hand, they want to be able to raise money from constituents and get votes by having shown they brought jobs into the state.
Yeah.
And this renewable energy transition offers a wonderful opportunity to get some unions into some of the red states, because, as you know, the UAW's had a tough time organizing auto plants in the South, right, for all the reasons you said, the captive audience meetings, the lies about the unions, the firing of union activists. For all these reasons, it's been hard for the unions to get into the South. And here we have an opportunity under this huge new program, the Inflation Reduction Act, to have lots of new plants built, but built in the states that don't have unions.
And so to create good jobs. I mean, at the end of it, for me, Don, it's about the jobs. It's about the future for working people. But in the first part of this is exposing it, which you've done a great job of doing. I hope people will take a look at the article over at exposedbycmd.org, exposed by the Center for Media and Democracy. Don Wiener,
right.
I appreciate you taking time. Great stuff. I'd love to have you come back again and as this continues down the road.
I appreciate you letting your listeners hear about this. It's pretty important.
Good stuff,
Don.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate the time. Thanks so much. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the first day of a new U.S. labor partnership, the Alliance for Labor Action. The alliance was forged by the president of the United Auto Workers, Walter Reuther, and the president of the Teamsters Union, Frank Fitzsimmons. The UAW had left the AFL-CIO over differences on how to approach labor organizing. The newly formed alliance with the Teamsters stood as a progressive alternative to the AFL-CIO's approach at the time. The ALA called for forming community unions for the millions of poor and unorganized workers. It supported the civil rights movement, as well as the movement against the war in Vietnam. One of the ALA's slogans was, quote, to find answers to the urgent problems of our society. The ALA developed position papers on a series of issues. One of those urgent problems was health care. The ALA described, quote, the United States is the last remaining industrialized country in the world which does not have a national health insurance plan which would assure all its citizens at least minimum guarantee of access to needed medical care. In 1969, the ALA launched its first major organizing drive in Atlanta, Georgia. The drive targeted multiple industries and included a massive advertising campaign. But the Atlanta business community stood in staunch opposition to the unionization effort. Despite some successes, the Atlanta effort did not garner the hoped-for results. The ALA suffered another blow when Walter Reuther died in a plane crash in May of 1970. The alliance disbanded in 1972. Universal health care and many of the other causes championed by the ALA remain unrealized. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Gee, shocker of shockers, Republicans going after working people. Who would have thunk it? And the American Legislative Exchange Council at the front of it, as they have been for the last, 50 years? It's just quite remarkable. Let's quick go to the phones. We got Jack online, too, calling from Wisconsin. Jack, what's on your mind, brother?
Well, first of all, this attack on the unions is nothing new, as I'm sure you realize. I am a retired teacher, and when Scott Walker cheated his way into office in Wisconsin, he got an all-Republican legislature, and one of the first things that they did was to legislate a thing called Act 10. Act 10 basically turned teaching into a right-to-work-for-less occupation, and it also removed the ability of teachers to bargain for anything except wages. So, for instance, if your school district was paying for your health insurance, they didn't have to anymore. They could simply say, we're not going to pay for it, so here's the bill. And this happened in several districts, and people ended up actually, even though they bargained for increased wages, that increase was nowhere close to what they lost when they had to pay much, much more for their health insurance. Another thing that you could not bargain for, you couldn't really bargain for anything, like I said, except wages, but another thing you couldn't bargain for is teaching load. And that was one of the reasons why I retired, although I was old enough to do that at the time anyway. But when I retired, my school district had six teachers teaching five science classes each. Now, that may be, doesn't sound like a lot of work for a lot of people, but in fact, to teach science, I had to get into the lab at 6:30 in the morning to start preparations. And I usually didn't get out until 4:30, 5 o'clock in the evening, so I had fairly long days teaching. When I left, nobody replaced me. They simply assigned each of the science teachers one additional class. So now we had they had five science teachers, each teaching six classes.
Wow!
This is the sort of thing that this kind of an attack on unions led to. And by the way, Scott Walker said, I'm not going to do right to work for the whole state. And then I think it was 2 years later, he did right to work for the whole state.
No, none of that was on his agenda. Look, I was sleeping on the Capitol floor when Act 10 was passed. We were one of the few radio programs in the country to broadcast within the Capitol when that was going on. And I remember I was there when they passed it like thieves in the night. And, you know, talk to those TAs from UW-Madison who were the catalysts for that whole uprising, because they actually read what was in the bill and how bad it was for them and their futures. And they're the ones who really stepped forward and brought all that about and exposed it, because you're right. The Republicans controlled everything. They could have just put it right through like thieves in the night and no one would have ever known until it was too late. But it was because of those graduate students that really brought that to light, and good on them. But, you know, again, it's all about attack on the public sector. It's all about attack on working people, which is why I always say Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. And I'm sad. Before I let you go, I got to get your thoughts on this, though. In Waukesha, there was a teacher fired for evidently protesting a ban on the song Rainbow Land. It's not that she taught the song. It's evidently she just was upset about the policy to not be able to, and was fired for this. Any thoughts?
That's a pretty outrageous infringement on freedom of speech. She posted that objection, and it was a relatively mild objection. It basically said, this is what was done. When is it going to end? And that was the essence of the whole Twitter remark. It was like two lines on Twitter. And she was fired for that, which is, to me, just unbelievable. But again, you have next to no protections anymore, again, because of the attack on public education. It's so bad that my son, who recently graduated from a UW school with a degree in teaching, moved to Minneapolis so he would not be teaching in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. I was going to ask you, how has this affected? I mean, that was 2011. Here we are 12 years later. How bad has it been for teachers in Wisconsin? What's it meant for the education system of your state?
Well, we used to have, if you believe these standardized tests that all of the conservatives think is the best way to evaluate your teaching, Wisconsin was number one, two, or three in the country in the ACT and SAT test before I retired. And now we're roughly in the top third, which wasn't a total disaster, but it certainly is a significant drop.
Yeah. Amazing stuff. But I appreciate the call, Jack. Good stuff. Wish you the best in Wisconsin, and I hope that I hope you turn that legislature around at some point soon. Appreciate the call. Thanks so much. No, look, I mean, you know, I remember this. I remember sleeping on the floor of the Capitol, and you know, we broadcast from out of Brett Halsey's office, and a number of the people that we met there, were part of the program for a while, as these horrible things rolled out. But the one thing I remember the most, I went to get my car, my oil changed at a service station just around the corner from the Capitol, and I met a guy who worked for the state, and he was retiring. Because he said, you know, Walker was privatizing everything. And he was retiring. He was going to get his pension. He was going to get his health care from the state. And he was going to do the exact same job he was doing for the state at twice the pay for a private company. That's what privatization and conservative policy gets the taxpayers. But I know. It's all about competition. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back after this.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Georgia on my mind. And, you know, for all the talk of Fannie Willis and they're going to go get Trump, the story about the next fixed election kind of coming into frame as the Georgia Secretary of State has announced a new purging. A new cleansing, I think the word is that they're using. We're going to cleanse some 200,000 people off the voter rolls. And gee, I wonder who those people could be. And here to share some thoughts on who that could be and, well, where we're going, I've asked our good friend Greg Palast to come talk with us. Greg is an investigative journalist, New York Times best-selling author, and the director of Vigilante, Georgia's vote suppression hitman. You can find all of that stuff at gregpalast.com. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to be with you again, Rick.
So here we are again. More purges, more kicking people off the rolls, more gimmicks.
Yeah, okay, here's what's going on. And I'm getting sick and tired of the lamestream media praising Brian Kemp, the GOP uber right-wing governor of Georgia, and his uber right-wing secretary of state. They hate Trump. It's an internal battle, but that doesn't make them heroes, because Trump attacked them for not fixing the election good enough for him. They really tried. Take my word for it. They really tried. So what the latest thing is that the state of Georgia, the Republican Secretary of State, much praised on 60 Minutes, has just announced the removal of another 191,000 voters from the voter rolls. Now, this is the guy who told 60 Minutes, who told the United States Congress, he didn't find a single provable case of an illegal voter voting in Georgia, not one. Yet he's removing 191,000 voters. Now, if these voters are illegal voters, yeah, they should go. But how did he find 191,000 illegal voters, yet not one of them had voted? The answer is, this is, yes, he says he has the cleanest voter rolls in America. Yes, he's bleached them whiter than white. We have to go back to my investigation, which I did for the ACLU and for Leonardo DiCaprio and his website. So the ACLU issued my report that when last time they did this purge of 198,000 voters, 300,000 voters, we found that 198,000 of them were all legal voters. Let me give you an example. In 2018, the same characters, well, that was Brian Kemp himself as Secretary of State before he became governor, removed 340,000 voters. In fact, exactly 340,144 voters who were legal voters. Those are statistics. Okay, let me give you the faces and names. Christine Jordan, 92 years old. I was there at the polling station when she was thrown out of the polling station. Not, she had her walker. By the way, it was storming outside. She's thrown back out in the storm saying, you can't vote here at this polling station. It was going to be her 50th year of voting at that polling station in Atlanta. Christine Jordan, by the way, the first year she voted was 1968, which was the year her cousin, Martin Luther King, was assassinated. So they literally removed Martin Luther King's 92-year-old cousin from the voter rolls, saying she didn't live in Atlanta anymore at her address. Well, I decided, you know, hey, she might be Martin Luther King's cousin. She might be 92, but she could be a scammer. So she agreed for me to go to her house, and there was her house right there near the polling station. And in addition, to prove that she'd been there the 50 years, there were pictures on the wall with her and her cousin King at the dining room table over the decades. So these are the people they are removing.
And how are they doing this? And what's the justification?
The justification is that for example, they sent them a notice. What they do is, I'll give you another great example. They send out notices and they say, oh, someone challenges and says they don't live in Georgia anymore or at that address, because they sent them a letter, it got bounced. In the case of Christine Jordan, she had her mail forwarded to her granddaughter down the street, still in the district. And they said, well, she's not living at that address because her mail was forwarded. Your mailing address is not it. The post office actually keeps address of convenience forwarding. How did I know 340,144 voters were illegally removed? We got the top experts in the nation working with the post office and using computers, obviously. We went through every single name and found out these people live where they live. Or they'll do something, they'll drive by and they'll say, oh, that looks empty, and they'll stop that. Or they'll send them a notice, here's where your polling station is, and the post office will screw up and send it back non-deliverable. Well, guess what? If you stay within your county, you move within your county, you don't have to re-register, you don't lose your vote. Who moves constantly? According to the U.S. Census, it's about 3-1 poor people to wealthier people. And the people that are most itinerant are called students. Some of us call them Democrats. I had one student, the same scam in Wisconsin, who had moved in, you know, he's moved his dorm room from one room to another in the same building. They took away his right to vote. He said he didn't live at his voting address. Yeah, he did. This is the game. And we looked through the racial profile. Well, look, the demographic profile was obvious. And that's why Stacey Abrams won the election in 2018. And they denied it to her. And now they want to make sure that in 2024, presidential candidate Brian Kemp wins Georgia.
So are you saying that they're rigging elections? Is that what you're saying? Because I get all my conservative friends, they think that the elections are rigged. Is this what you're telling me?
Yeah, but you know, when Trump used to say the election's rigged, as I wrote in my book, How Trump Stole 2020, good close prediction. Of course he said that they're rigged, because he's rigging them with his friends. By the way, if you want to see him say that, the film The Best Democracy Money Can Buy is free for download, available at gregpalast.com. So you can see Trump say it himself and our response in detail, which takes a couple of fun hours. But the truth is, it's been a massive, massive vote suppression game. And what's really bugging me, I was talking with a journalism professor last night, and he and I were furious together about something, which is the New York Times is always in the mainstream media, always running stories about how elections, that there's massive racial vote suppression, massive suppression of the student vote, basically Democratic votes. But they have never, ever, ever reported, by the way, that vote suppression cost these elections. Stacey Abrams, Al Gore, 358 votes. There's all this vote suppression, but hey, it didn't make a difference. So they will never actually say an election's been stolen. Well, I'll say it. But the thing is, and now they're using – the problem is that they're using like I heard my good friend, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, say we have to have more censorship of the internet so that we don't allow people to say elections have been stolen. Well, Jan, I'm one of your close friends. I've said it was stolen. You repeated my words back in 2000. We just have to stop. When it's not the issue of whether elections are stolen, it's who and how. I was with the Justice Department. We didn't say, oh, a crime was committed. We look for the perpetrators. and look for their methods and put them in prison. So right. It's the people who did it.
Well, I think the difference is you know, when people think that the election was stolen, that there are some nefarious folks working in dark shadows, you know, taking thumb drives or driving around ballots or doing all kinds of things under the cloak of darkness. Whereas what Republicans have done election cycle after election cycle is just use the mechanisms of government to move the laws in a way that allow them just to throw people off and don't let them participate.
Well, in fact, we sued the NAACP Black Voters Matter Fund, and I was an expert witness in the case, sued in federal court the last time they removed 198,000 people, and based on my ACLU investigation. And, you know, the problem we run into is the courts say, oh, it's too late to allow these people to vote, to correct the voter rolls. Yeah. It's too late to correct the voter rolls. Then when you sue in advance, they say it's too early. It's very hard with the courts we have now.
Because well, those two are decidedly in the pocket of the wealth class. And again, you wonder why they want to purge Democratic votes, why they want to stop Democratic votes from happening, because, well, the wealth class probably couldn't exist without doing that.
You wonder why the
decider of government decides who gets what and why the wealth class always gets what they need and working people always get screwed. You wonder how that plays out. And this is a huge part of it.
Well, as I've always said, vote suppression is class war by other means. And most of my work shows the massive racial disparity. But, you know, race is kind of the mark of lower income in America. But when you really look, when I'm a statistician and an economist by training, when I look, do deep dives into these statistics, the reason it looks racial is that it's class. We go after low income people on get them off the voter rolls. You'll see this like the group that's most under attack are the American native voters from the Pueblos and the tribes in the West. Like, for example, I was just at the Osage Reservation. They were talking about how they had to do an emergency voter registration education drive in Arizona, because Arizona literally removed polling stations from reservations. I don't mean that they reduced the number of stations. There were reservations where they completely eliminated polling stations. By the way, in case you're wondering, indigenous people of America are solid Democrats. Now, you're shocked, I know that, but they're also not the wealthiest people in America. I know some people say, oh, casino Americans, but you go to the Pueblos and I don't see a lot of riches out there, okay? So it is class war by other means. And they go after students. They go after, and I've seen low-income areas in New Mexico where the machines didn't register a single vote for president of the United States. How about that? I mean, and now this is not, by the way, this is not about Trump's thing with Dominion and all that. They're going to cymatic that they're some guy like Lex Luthor and Stacey Abrams and
it's not even conspiratorial. I don't think, Greg.
I just want to get rid of the idea that there's someone in a cave messing with the software. In 20 some years of this business, I've never seen a software change affect an election at all, ever. But what you do see is machines shut down. It's real simple. In Florida, we saw 28,000 votes disappear simply because they lost the chips from certain precincts. They don't have to know how you vote to mess with you, because people vote like their neighbors. If you are in a low income African American area in Tampa, it pretty much, if you eliminate that precinct by a glitch, again, they're not messing with the software. It's not complicated stuff. It literally gets glitched.
Or just an old machine that broke down.
Yeah, they give the crap, you know, it's statistics. Yeah. They give the crap machines into low-income areas, just like they give crap hospitals, crap schools, crap police. And you get the crap voting machines. You know, there's no magic to this. There's no great conspiracy. It's pretty simple, crude stuff. But I have to say, I've got my Swiss in-laws here, and they're like, they can't believe this is how America, the land of democracy, is operates.
Yeah, you listen to the Rick Smith Show with Greg Palast, investigative journalist, New York Times bestselling author, and the director of Vigilante, Georgia's Vote Suppression Hitman, a must-see. You can find all that stuff at gregpalast.com. I want to get to that movie, though, because all of this stuff is in that movie of yours. All of this shouldn't be a shock to anyone. We've talked about this before. In October and November last year, we did a number of events around the country, you know, showing your movie. This is they're right out in front doing this stuff. There's no cloak and dagger. There's no smoke filled room. They're just out in front doing it.
Well, I have to say, by the way, you can't get Vigilante right now, because here's the exclusive breaking story for Rick Smith. We're remaking it. It was Vigilante, Georgia's Vote Suppression Hitman. Now it's going to be America's Vote Suppression Hitman, because we're taking this on the road to Arizona, North Carolina, Texas, Oklahoma, you name it, because this game, unfortunately, the tricks that they tried in Georgia and took for test drive in Georgia are now national. And so we'll be doing that. But you can get the film The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which will give you a lot of this story. Also, gregpalast.com. That's a free download.
So if I'm getting this straight, because in the movie, there were a couple of people, one woman who threatened you with a gun,
yes,
who challenged thousands of their neighbors, people they had no idea who they were, challenged their right to vote. That's coming to other states? That's going to maybe come to a state near us?
Well, yes. So what's happened is that they've expanded the right of individuals, that is vigilantes, to challenge someone else's vote. This GOP operative, and I want to remind you that she was a vice chair of the Republican Party in Georgia. 88 GOP operatives challenged 250,000 voters. This one woman challenged 36,000 voters. One woman. She couldn't even print out the name. She challenged somebody. She just handed it in a hard drive, said, don't let these people vote. We were able to, by the way, through the film and our actions in coordination with the voting groups like Black Voters Matter, we got that whole challenge blocked. We blocked almost every one of those challenges. But the law says anyone could challenge, and people don't know they've been challenged, and then it's too late. So luckily, through our action, but the problem is Georgia's bringing it back, making it harder for us to challenge the challenges, and they're spreading it to other states. Texas is going big time, and this is being led by groups like True the Vote.
So bad policy coming to states across. And look, am I surprised by this? No, because that's the only way they can seem to win elections, is by ensuring that the people don't actually vote. And then what I love, and this is, you know, masterful on their part, they then claim that when they don't win, everything's been stolen and rigged, and they've got a megaphone that's so large and powerful that's the message that gets taken. And we've got a corporate-controlled media who seems to be either laying down on the job or complicit. I don't know which is why, again, we don't hear these stories like the ones you're breaking.
Well, that is a problem. I mean, I was, you know, remember, most of my stories came out of Europe. I was with BBC Television and The Guardian. And almost all the vote suppression stories I did are all over Europe, all over the world. But in the U.S., it's very, very hard to get them into the mainstream, even when I've put it in places like Rolling Stone or Harper's. But God forbid the New York Times or Washington Post should pick this up. You know, they'll pick up once in a while, like they picked up when the ACLU, Black Voters Matter Fund, sued. Then they don't have to investigate. It's a lazy way of reporting. They just say, Black Voters Matter Fund and NAACP have sued the state of Georgia saying illegal voter removal. State of Georgia says, no, that's not true. He said, she said, good night.
Yeah.
But, you know, they are, you know, you have what I call lazy F-ism in American journalism. They don't want to do the work. It's not easy. It takes months to do this work. It takes a lot of money to do this work. And, you know, they're not going to do that. Plus, what do they get out of it? You know, so it's much easier to cover the Trump follies and say, oh, Trump tells us the lie that the votes were stolen. But then they use that to smear the Republicans, say, oh, well, Trump is lying, just like this is Secretary of State of Georgia, the Republican Secretary of State. He says, well, Trump is making up this story that the votes are stolen in Georgia, but so is Stacey Abrams. So are the Democrats. They're claiming that the election was stolen from her. No, we're not claiming. We proved it with the numbers. Exactly. With the names of voters. I literally have the list of the names of voters illegally removed. I have, and I have many of them on film, sometimes in tears, sometimes in frustration. But that's the evidence. Don't look for it in your lamestream paper.
There you go. Greg, I got to get your thoughts on this as well. I mean, the Supreme Court just shot down affirmative action at universities because, heaven forbid, qualified people get, you know, an equal shot in this. But I saw a New York Times story that because one of the things they didn't go after was legacy people. George W. Bush couldn't get into the University of Texas, but Harvard and Yale, yeah, why not? And they had a piece today on the, you know, on the study of elite college admissions. And they said that, you know, being rich is its own qualification. Are we surprised by that?
No. In fact, I would like, now this is a good reason to go to GregPalace.com. I want you to read my story, Confessions of an Affirmative Action Baby. When I was young, and I grew up in the anus of Los Angeles, Pacoima, mostly Hispanic neighborhood, and we were designated losers. Our job was to go to Vietnam. There was a test given to kids at Beverly Hills High and University High, the rich kids, that would allow them to get into UCLA early. I found out about it, demanded to take the test, aced it, but there was one problem. I flunked basic English because I grew up in a place, and they called my principal. I said, this guy has these high numbers, but he can't speak basic English. Now, normally that would prohibit you from going to the University of California. But they ignored it. They said, we're going to give this. The principal said, it's lucky he speaks English at all from our school. And so they gave me a break. This is affirmative action. And I ended up getting into there and you know, Stanford and Columbia, Chicago, et cetera. But, and then now, yes, I couldn't speak basic English. So it's supposed to be fair. But they gave me a break because I was not taught basic English. Let me tell you something. When this decision on affirmative action is not as horrible as it seems, because the real issue is, again, class. 43% of the non-white non-Asian admissions to Harvard, the so-called affirmative action students, 43% of them come from families with incomes well over $100,000. The legacy, if you are in the top 0.1%, in other words, not the top 1%, but the top 0.1%, one out of 1,000 richest families, your chance of getting into big schools like Harvard or Stanford is 2.2 times higher than if your income is average. So, and that has nothing to do with being a legatee or anything. They literally are looking for people who are super rich to let their kids in with the idea, yep, that, well, maybe they'll get some donation. So being super rich is a number one qualification or an elite school, whether your daddy went there or not. And then you get to the legacies. I mean, I'm sorry. Sasha Obama does not need to have a, should not be counted as an affirmative action choice by a big university. So what's happened is, but it was pointed out by the people who sued and said end racial affirmative action, because racial affirmative action been a cover for letting in elites of a darker skin. And that's how it's been used overwhelmingly. They said, well, you could, if Harvard is really serious about bringing in black people, we did a calculation that if you eliminated the legacy admissions, and legacy admissions by that means your daddy went to Harvard or your grandpa went to Harvard. George Bush giggles about how he was a C student and got into Yale, forgetting, you know, not failing or failing to mention that his grandfather was on the board of trustees of Yale when he was admitted to Yale.
Yeah.
And he was a C student. So it's about class. They can completely racially integrate these elite schools if they eliminate the legacy and additional bonuses for simply being morbidly rich. You could literally, you won't need any affirmative action if you eliminate the affirmative action for the uber rich.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I found interesting the day the ruling came out. I said, you know, look, you know, legacy, the moneyed folks, the people who have the elites, they're well taken care of. Everybody else, not so much. The website, gregpalast.com. You can find all the great stuff there of his investigative journalism, his best-selling books, and also his movies there for view. And I can't wait for the new one, Greg. When it comes out, I'd love to have it. Have you, maybe we'll do an event together.
You bet we will. So yeah, but Best Democracy Money Can Buy will be available on the site now for free.
There you go. GregPalast.com. Thanks so much, Greg. Appreciate the time. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Again, GregPalast.com. Make sure you check it out. Back after this.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
And I got to tell you, it's interesting to me to see how across the country, states doing really well, from Pennsylvania, Alabama, Washington, all across the country. 17 states have seen their jobless rates record lows. And, you know, the thing that's interesting is you've got a lot of these red states, you know, places like South Dakota that they got what, 1.8% unemployment. We're talking a major boom, major investments going into these places. And it's got to be a little awkward for these red state politicians who, you know, are saying, look how wonderful the economy is, and then trying to bash Biden for the economy. It's just kind of difficult. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So what do you think of this? I mean, the economy's doing well in a lot of places. You've got unemployment at record lows in a lot of places. And yet I listen to my conservative friends and it's all about, you know, we're going to hit a recession tomorrow. It's all doomsday because they need it to be.
Well, the recession went, as some experts predicted, not a recession. It, you know, it took a bump and a hump and this and that, but didn't turn into what, you know, everybody was expecting to happen, especially after 2 years of COVID and the supply chain and inflation, you know, on and on. Now, the big deal, and as you mentioned, it's in a lot of red states, but the manufacturing boom. And it has, you know, obviously created, according to the statistics, 800,000 some manufacturing jobs nationwide, which is the area what, you know, we need to accomplish, what we need to do. You know, Trump was real big on manufacturing 2016, and, you know, that helped him in some states. And this is actually producing, you know, a lot of jobs. And, you know, Biden is taking credit, of course, for those jobs. But the Republicans, you know, are constantly, you know, hammering him about the economy. And so part of the problem, I think, that the Democratic side is going to have to deal with and, you know, grab a hold of and continue to, you know, to point out, of course, you know, Republicans voted against most of the president's proposals, and they're going to have to keep that message out there, because, you know, still sometimes in the polling, the president is not getting people aboard as he should. So it's messaging.
No, it's
now
completely messaging.
They can do it a lot of ways.
No, you're spot on. And, you know, what also is happening, we talked a little bit earlier with Don Wiener from the Center for Media and Democracy. He's pointing out that in a number of red states, start expecting this ALEC legislation that's going to start hitting to preempt union organizing in a lot of these places. You know, Ford went into Tennessee, is going into Tennessee, and Ford has a neutrality agreement with the UAW, and Tennessee lost their mind that how dare those jobs be union jobs that are going to pay good wages. So they're saying, look, they passed a law, any state subsidies that go to any of these places, you got to go and bust those unions. And we're expecting ALEC to push that across the country. Again, keeping wages down, keeping the kind of growth that could happen, you know, stymied. That seems to be the plan.
Well, it is. And ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, doesn't do this by accident.
Nope.
You know, there are think tank people, money, et cetera, you know, behind this. We had this push at one point in time in Ohio when I was there. It was the ABC, it was called, American Building Conference and the Council. And they would coordinate, and, you know, these people would support ALEC, and then they would try to get this legislation going as much as possible in as many, you know, states as possible. Now, for example, the transportation bill, when Bush was president, Andy Card had a fit. That was the chief of staff. He wanted, you know, the federal tinkering, I call it, you know, which would have been completely destructive for jobs and the trades. You know, he wanted that undone in the federal transportation bills. He wasn't successful. So, you know, there are people out there that have done and will continue to do this type of thing, which will erode the working wages, and then they'll complain. The same people, Rick, will complain about, well, you know, look at the wages under Biden. You know, they're not there.
No, I mean, it's amazing that these groups never seem to run out of bad ideas. I mean, they pay people a lot of money to think up how to harm working people, and this is the next iteration of that. You know, right? You know, passing the No Rights at Work agenda, that wasn't enough. Now, going to force employers. I mean, this is remarkable to me. If you want tax subsidies, if you want help in building your facilities and, you know, education and any of that stuff, you have to harass and intimidate your workers. You have to threaten to fire them. You have to coerce them. You have to do all that stuff. You can't just say, I'll be neutral, and you decide. No, you got to fight, which is, it's twisted to me.
Well, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's just like, you know, none of the local governments say, we're going to have, you know, some development monies here. We're going to build an industrial park, and you must come in union. They don't say that.
No.
You know, it's up to union to, you know, get the organization going. But if you reverse this, these groups want it to actually be said that you can't be.
That's,
you know, you have to do this. You have to do that.
This is amazing.
It's not even a fair shake for union organizing. So it's again, it's planned. It's not by accident.
Nope, none of this stuff is. Got to get some of your thoughts on some other stories I ran across. The dumbest guy in the U.S. Senate still holding up nearly 300 senior military promotions. I guess we still don't have a commandant for the Marine Corps. Is that accurate?
That's correct. You know, when you just said that, my mind flashed when you said the dumbest guy. I was trying to debate out of three or four people. Now I know who you're talking about. Well, we don't. After, you know, what, how many years, 100 and some years, and we don't have it. And, of course, you know, he went after used the House to go after the Defense Authorization Bill, which is, you know, not going to cut it in the Senate. But he's got that power to hold up appointments, and that's what he's done with the commandant.
Yeah, now you've got a number of Democrats who have sent a letter to Mitch McConnell saying, hey, can you deal with the dumbest guy in the Senate? You know, maybe give him a lollipop or something?
Right. Well, you know, that's the other thing about the Senate I just could never stand. You know, any senator, now it used to be done in secret, usually it leaks out, but any senator can put holds on, one senator can put a hold on something.
Or, you know? As I say, it's the place where progress goes to die. And there it is. I got to get your thought on the fake electors.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Michigan and Dana Nessel, who I you know, we interviewed on our Working Class Heroes radio tour, and she's fantastic. Charged these 16 people in the fake elector scheme. My favorite story of the day today, one of the women, she says she was duped into it. She didn't want to do it. She was duped into it. In fact, I think she said that they actually took her name off of an index card and did it that way, forged her name. I guess that's the argument.
Well, you and I talked about this last week on your show when you know the article came out about it was about 6 days or so ago. We talked about this. And I remember we were talking also about the fact that, you know, you're going to start to hear things because when these profiles in Courage get caught, then they're going to start to, well, I didn't know, or yep. or he made me do it.
He made me do
which
it.
Doesn't absolve them from their sin. But you're going to, a lot of stuff's going to come out. Yeah. So this is not going to be the only state to do this. A lot of stuff is going to come out.
The rats will start
jumping
ship. And then they're
going to connect dots. For the whole thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, the rats are going to start jumping ship, and it's going to be interesting, which is why I think you got Mitt Romney out there, you know, urging the GOP to, hey, can we find somebody else, anyone? Republicans are going to lose, and I think he knows that. But, you know, it's the base, man.
Well, look at Laura Ingraham, who on her show said, you know, right out front, Will you please stop talking about the last election? She said that to Trump. They know that this, you know, constant referral to the last election is obviously also stepping on any message that the Republicans want to get out there. I would hate to be running for Congress today trying to get around the noise to get your message out.
No, I mean, Trump's a major disruptor. And the thing is, you know, who are the Republicans going to get behind? DeSantis? Have you looked at the mess of his campaign? I guess over the weekend he was with a bunch of donors saying, well, we're gonna shake things up. We're going to do better.
DeSantis did, and you know this, you know grassroots politics better than anybody I know. What happened to DeSantis? After, of course, he had the amazing ad that he had, which was, I don't know what I thought that ad was, but he had that ad, and then on top of everything, what's he do the next week? Fires the campaign manager, redoes the decks on the Titanic on his campaign. Anytime you see that happening, then you know they're in trouble. There were calls at one point in time, remember, for Karl Rove to go, and Bush was smart. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. Because once you start down that road, then your campaign is in a chaotic mess, and that's what has happened to DeSantis. Plus, he has to understand something. What worked in Florida for him, drag shows and Disney World and et cetera, et cetera. It's not. I don't know, but maybe I'm old fashioned, but I don't hear that here in Ohio. Yeah. Well, we need to make him president so he can do something about Disney World and the drag queens. Let's put him in. I don't hear that here.
Yeah, well, there is that. But then the other choice, Mike Pence. And I love the fact that, he was on CNN with Dana Bash, and he claimed that he wasn't worried about Trump's rhetoric. And she's like, that's pretty remarkable that you're not concerned about it, given the fact that they wanted to hang you on January 6th. I think that is the greatest response, because for me, for with Mike Pence, every question would start with, so when they wanted to hang you, and then whatever the question was. But that has to be front and center. And he's never really addressed that.
No. Well, and let's look at, Ted Cruz. His father tried to kill President Kennedy. His wife was disgusting looking, and he ended up supporting Trump. I mean, I'm just thinking, how far do you have to go? Did Trump have to actually try to put the noose around Pence before he would say something? How far do you have to go?
Exactly.
I don't get it.
You brought up the Ted Cruz thing, and my wife laughed when you said that. Trump made fun of his wife, called her ugly. He did. And I've said a number of times, had he said that to me in that space, we'd be rolling around on the ground.
Sure, absolutely. And it would be okay to grab him and roll him around on the ground over it. I don't get it. And Pence, of course, Pence is like watching paint dry, and he's not going to get anywhere.
So who is the Republican alternative? Do you think that, I mean, because there's a, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy, you got Nikki Haley, you got a whole bunch of people, Youngkin, they're courting. You know, who do you think, if it's not going to be Trump, where do you think they end up going?
Well, I just don't see DeSantis as,
no.
You know, he might be the, quote, most conservative, but he's not even getting traction in circles. So I would assume they've got to go with Nikki Haley or Chris Christie. I know he had the bridge thing, but, you know, politicians have their scandals and in return. But if I'm looking at the candidates, I mean, it's not going to be Pence.
No,
Pence, you know, was marked by Trump. And so I think Haley or Chris Christie, Vivek Ramaswamy, I just don't, they might take him as a VP choice, but I just think at this point in time, it's got to be Christie or Nikki Haley, unless they pull somebody else out.
Yeah, I don't see Christie. I just don't see the base. I fear him, but I just don't see the base.
Well, here's the thing, too, about the base that, you know, we don't know. If it's not Trump, do they sit there and say, well, I'm angry and, you know, I'll just let Joe Biden serve another term? I don't think they will, but there won't be the same obvious excitement. Well, that's why I still say Nikki Haley.
Yeah.
She doesn't seem to have suffered what Pence and Christie and even DeSantis have. Of course, yeah. DeSantis is getting it because of Trump himself.
No, it'll be interesting. It'd be interesting to see if you know, because I had someone tell me the other day they don't think Biden's gonna make it to the nomination or to the election. So it would be interesting to see a Kamala Harris, Nikki Haley, you know, lineup. Which you know, I don't even want to get into what I think would happen there.
I am not taking that bait on your show either.
All right, slow rolled that one out. That was an easy one for you. It's an easy grounder.
I'm having my mind go somewhere else. And what other Republican candidates are out there? So, yeah.
Okay. And finally, I wanted to get your thoughts on, I had a listener, you know, tell me that the Obamas murdered their chef.
Oh.
Is that what we're going to hear tomorrow?
I mean, you know, what I would say to the right, you know, do they think his food was that bad, really, that they can actually try to pin this? There was one, wasn't a mainstream, but I did actually see somebody, you know, put out, well, this is sort of like the Clintons, you know, all the people that were around the Clintons that, yeah, quote, died as a result. This is sort of like the Clintons. They weren't there. He had an accident. And they tried this. I wish I could remember this site. They tried to twist it about, you know, how he died, and that somebody was seen pulling his body out, which was already dead before he got into water, which I want to say, how do they know that since there's been no coroner report?
See, the Obamas not being there, that's their move. That's how they do it. That's how they kill people. They're not there.
Right. Now, I did see that on one site, though, that they knew that he was already deceased when they pulled him out of the water. That was their statement. He was deceased when they pulled him out of the water.
Yeah, because he drowned. That's what happens when you drown.
Right.
Oh, wow. Well, we'll see. We'll see how this plays out. But as always, Bob, I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Rick.
Thoughts. Always good stuff. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? Love to hear it. Also, remember, check out the podcast. Never miss a moment. Take the show on the go. Quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. Workers organized the first general strike in American history. The strike was an outgrowth of the railroad strike, which you may know if you're a regular listener of Labor History in 2, that started 10 days earlier in Martinsburg, West Virginia. The drastic wage cuts demanded by competing railroad magnates brought about a work stoppage in East St. Louis on July 22nd. Railroad workers voted to go on strike, shutting down all freight traffic. The strike quickly spread across the river to St. Louis, which at the time was the nation's third largest manufacturing city. The St. Louis strike was led by the Socialist Working Man's Party. The Working Man's Party called for a mass meeting at Lucas Market that gathered an enormous crowd of thousands of workers to declare their strike. The St. Louis strikers set out clear goals of ending child labor and establishing an 8-hour workday. By the next day, the strike had almost completely shut the city down. The strike lasted nearly a week. However, divisions between rank and file and strike leadership emerged over issues of race. The demonstrations that emerged in the afternoon of the 25th were led by a group of Black River workers. In an interview following the strike, an executive committee member said, "We did all we could to get the crowd to disperse." He wanted to keep white strikers from following the lead of Black workers. The city's upper classes, startled by the events, began organizing a militia to quell the strike. Finally, federal troops arrived in St. Louis to crush the uprising. Special deputized police joined their forces. They arrested the strike leaders, injured hundreds, and killed at least 18 people.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
On our website, thericksmithshow.com. I want to get to a couple of quick emails before we wrap up. See, Lewis sent me an email, said he thought I handled the call with CJ wonderfully. Look, I just having a conversation. He said the problem I have with CJ's logic is one is very individualistic. He says, quote, "Why should I pay for paternity leave when I don't plan to have any kids? Simple answer is, even though he may not need it, someone else will, and what he pays a portion is to be used by the insurance company to cover paternity care for those who do." It's the idea that us folks who believe in community and the idea of being a brother's keeper and all that stuff plays into it. And basic insurance, that's the other part. Lewis goes on to say, "It's the same dribble I hear from some of my neighbors who complain about having to pay taxes that fund our public schools when their kids have graduated a long time ago. My response is, you do have an interest, because the better schools, the better the property values of the homes in the district, meaning the asset they own grows in value. Geez, whatever happened to the notion of the common good and value in community?" And this is where we've been sold this from Reagan forward. Hooray for me, and the heck with everyone else. My problem again with this idea of piecemeal insurance is that somebody is going to make a mistake. You know, I don't need cancer care. Well, what happens when you get cancer? The taxpayer picks this up. The problem with health insurance, and I've had this conversation 1,000 times, is that we as taxpayers pay for the most costly people, which are our children, first 5 years, last 5 years of life, seniors. The idea that we're going to take the most expensive portion of caring for society out of the insurance pool, and we're going to say we're going to fund that with tax dollars, is remarkable to me. I'm simply a believer in one giant pool. Everybody in. One pool. That's it. Everybody. Anyone who knows anything about actuarial tables and basic insurance knows that the larger the pool, the smaller the risk. And look, I'm not opposed to the idea of health savings accounts as an extra, but not as a way that we have a public policy, because some people are going to be luckier than others. Some people are going to end up having, you know, much more costly. We had a caller earlier said, you know, a couple of days in the hospital was, you know, 400 grand. That money, that finite amount that you have in your health savings account, evaporates pretty quickly in that environment. And what happens if you're sick young and you don't get to build those years? There's a lot of, sorry, it's not a workable solution for when you're talking about everybody. I'm not against, you know, a portion going in that direction. I'm actually kind of in favor of the idea. I think it was the Heritage Foundation or the Inter-American Enterprise Institute or one of them who came out and said, you know, now, every baby that's born, you know, the government should put 10 grand into an account and just leave it there. I'm not opposed to that idea. I don't know where the money would come from. I need it neither. But the idea of allowing that throughout a lifetime to build wealth, that's not a bad idea. It's what rich people do. Wouldn't be a bad idea for working people. But on the healthcare front, you know, this idea of, again, you know, I keep having people tell me we're a Christian nation, but we don't bother that heal the sick, take care of our neighbor thing very much. So, yeah, when I hear people say, oh, I only want what I want, that's selfish. But that's what, you know, 40 years of Reaganomics have gotten us. That's what Hooray for Me and the Heck with Society gets us. That's what, you know, the greed is good. The one who dies with the most toys wins. That's where that comes from. And it's what is spewed in right-wing circles. Why should I have to pay for those women having children? Because we want to have kids that are healthy, that we need, you know, to help the next generation, that we will, you know, maybe that next generation of kids that are going to grow up to be doctors that'll take care of you, even though you didn't have kids. You know, maybe the person who's going to, you know, I don't know, the arguments the right makes to me about being against abortion. Maybe that kid's going to cure cancer. But it never seems to work. It's always hooray for me. So I appreciate the email, Lewis. It's, again, I wish we could come back to that idea of the common good, of you know, taking care of our neighbors. You know, kind of like what Jason Aldean says his song is about, without it actually being about that. Just interesting times that we live in. But I want to hear your thoughts. Is there something that I said got under your skin, on your nerves? By all means, I want to hear it. Or do you have a healthcare story? I mean, at the end of the day, we've all got them. How should we fix our healthcare situation? What would be the best way? I think one giant insurance pool. I want to hear yours. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Tomorrow we are off in D.C. for an event. Going to finish up our coverage of Netroots Nation. Back in the studio on Wednesday. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.